dramatic escalation. This is the assault on Fed independence that many people have been clutching their pearls about.
President Trump is trying to fire a member of the Federal Reserve's governing board. What could that mean for the economy and the Fed?
For Tuesday, August 26th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, we'll meet a reconstructive surgeon in Lebanon who's helping Gazan children recover from war wounds.
You get your strength from the patients and their families, and therefore you always feel that they don't have the luxury for you to give up.
Also, the digital afterlife industry is booming.
Yeah, if you could talk to an AI avatar of a dead relative, would you?
There is powerful rhetoric with a dead bot because it is tapping into all of that emotional longing and vulnerability.
And an 83-year-old lifeguard in New Jersey has been patrolling the shore since he was a teen. Now he's a world record holder.
Now news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. In a cabinet meeting that lasted more than 3 hours, President Trump highlighted his crime-fighting efforts in Washington, D.C., among many other topics. NPR's Tamara Keith reports he was also showered with praise by cabinet secretaries.
Trump boasted that bringing in thousands of National Guard troops and federal agents has made the nation's capital safe, and said he wants any murders committed in the district to be punished by the death penalty. Trump also repeated a line he has used several times lately, saying people would be okay with a dictator.
If he stops crime, he can be whatever he wants. I'm not a dictator, by the way, but he can be whatever he wants. I think it's going to be a big subject for the midterms, and I think the Republicans are going to do really well.
This set a record as Trump's longest event ever. Tamara Keith, NPR News, the White House.
Democratic leaders are looking to derail President Trump's threats to send National Guard troops to other cities, including Chicago and Baltimore. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker and others call the threat a political move and accuse Trump of ignoring cities with worse crime rates that have Republican leaders. Trump administration officials have made a risky copy of millions of American Social Security numbers. That's according to a new whistleblower complaint. NPR's Jeff Brumfield says a copy was made even though red flags were raised.
The Social Security Administration's chief data officer says Trump appointees copied the agency's entire numerical identification system database to a private cloud environment. The database contains Social Security numbers of over 300 million Americans, along with other details including place of birth and parents' names. Andrea Meza is an attorney with the nonprofit Government Accountability Project, which represents the whistleblower.
It's a lot of really personal data on millions and millions of Americans.
Cybersecurity staff within the Social Security Administration warned the move was high risk, but the copy was made anyway. The agency says the copy is in a place, quote, walled off from the internet. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News, Washington.
A new survey finds the life satisfaction level for the Gen Z population has dropped to its lowest in the past 3 years. NPR's Janet Ujong Lee reports that this drop was primarily driven by Gen Z adults rather than current students.
According to the recently released Gallup-Walton Family Foundation poll, less than half of Gen Z believe their lives are, quote, thriving. That means they feel positive about their lives right now and believe it'll stay that way for the next 5 years. The survey shows this response from Gen Z adults is driven by the lasting impact of the coronavirus pandemic, which they say caused social anxieties for some, as well as current economic uncertainties of the job market and rising living costs. Janet Ujong Lee, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News. The National Endowment of the Arts has canceled its Creative Writing Fellowship. For decades, the program has supported writers who would go on to become big names in literature. But NPR's Andrew Limbong reports the NEA has told applicants for next year's grants that the program has been canceled.
Alice Walker, Michael Cunningham, Louise Erdrich, these are just a few names of authors who won an NEA Creative Writing Fellowship. The program began in 1966 to support America's literary creativity. In 2026, the program would have awarded 35 writers up to $50,000 each. That is until last week, when authors began posting on social media an email they got from the NEA stating that the fellowship has been canceled. Under the Trump administration, millions of dollars in grant funding towards literary endeavors have been canceled, ostensibly in favor of projects celebrating America's upcoming 250th anniversary. The president has also proposed getting rid of the NEA entirely. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook says she will sue the Trump administration over its attempt to fire her. Cook's lawyer issued a statement today after Trump last night cited allegations of mortgage fraud for her removal. Cook is the first black woman to serve as a Fed governor. She has said that she will not step down. Despite concerns about the Fed's independence, Wall Street closed higher today. The S&P 500 rose 0.4% to end the day at 6,465 points. The NASDAQ also gained 0.4%, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 0.3% to 45,418. I'm Jahlil Snyder. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
It is 4:06. Thanks for listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Partly cloudy overnight, lows in the low to mid-50s with calm winds, and tomorrow, mostly sunny, high 75 to 80, slight chance for showers in the afternoon, and looking ahead to Thursday, mostly sunny, high 68 to 72. Coming up at 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Right now, we continue with All Things Considered on KAXE.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. President Trump is trying to fire a member of the Federal Reserve's governing board, but Lisa Cook is not going quietly. Cook and her attorney say Trump has no authority to remove her from the central bank, and they've promised to challenge her dismissal in court. The conflict marks a new chapter in Trump's campaign to wield more control over the central bank. NPR's Scott Horsley is covering this. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Ari.
Okay, so Trump said in this social media post last night that he has lost confidence in Lisa Cook. What's the backstory here?
Well, this comes after Bill Poulte, a Trump loyalist who oversees mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, accused Cook of making false statements on a mortgage application 4 years ago. That was before she was appointed to the Fed board by then-President Biden. Poulte says Cook applied for home loans weeks apart on two different properties in two different states, and that she claimed each property would be her primary residence, which usually comes with more favorable loan terms. Now, this is just an allegation. There haven't been any formal charges, but Trump says it's reason enough for him to fire Cook.
We need people that are 100% above board, and it doesn't seem like she was.
But Cook insists she's not going anywhere and that she'll continue to carry out her duties at the central bank. For the moment, financial markets are kind of in a holding pattern.
So if the two of them are in this standoff, what happens now?
Cook and her attorney, Abby Lowell, plan to file a lawsuit as early as tomorrow to have this firing set aside. Under the law, the Fed is supposed to operate independently from the White House, and Fed governors can only be fired for serious misconduct. Peter Conte Brown, who's a Fed historian at the University of Pennsylvania, believes the allegation of mortgage fraud here is just a pretext. He says this is really about Trump's campaign to get the Fed to sharply lower interest rates.
This is a dramatic escalation. And this is, in a sense, open warfare. This is the assault on Fed independence that many people have been clutching their pearls about. These aren't tweets. These aren't ad hominem attacks. This is a putative attempt to run roughshod over the Federal Reserve.
In a statement this afternoon, the Fed underscored its commitment to operating independently and said it would abide by any court decision in Cook's lawsuit.
Beyond the Fed, there's kind of a pattern here of President Trump firing people who work for agencies that are supposed to be independent. Tell us about the track record.
Yeah, he's managed to fire a number of people who ran nominally independent agencies, despite a 90-year-old Supreme Court precedent limiting a president's power to do so. Trump and his allies have been chipping away at that precedent. They argue no agency is really independent of the president's powers. Conte Brown says a majority of the current Supreme Court seems inclined to go along with that argument, but maybe not when it comes to the central bank.
The Supreme Court has strongly hinted that it's going to abolish that legal protection in every part, in every corner of the federal government, with one exception, the Federal Reserve.
Most economists agree that central banks around the world just work better when they're allowed to operate free from political interference. That way they can take the sometimes unpopular steps that are necessary, like raising interest rates to fight inflation.
So what happens if Trump is allowed to fire Cook?
Well, Trump has already picked two members of the Fed's governing board, and he's in line to name a third. If he's also allowed to replace Cook, that would give him Trump appointees a majority on the seven-member Fed board. Trump also gets to nominate a new chairman when Jerome Powell's term expires next spring. So all this could be a chance for this very hands-on president to exercise more control over the central bank, and it could potentially spell the end of the Fed's storied independence.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The digital afterlife industry. We're talking about companies managing online identities after death. It's expected to hit close to $80 billion within a decade. And a key driver are AI avatars of the dead, or dead bots. As these simulations grow eerily lifelike, some tech companies see big dollars. But as NPR's Chloe Veltman reports, researchers and others warn of troubling consequences.
AI avatars of deceased people are showing up in new and unexpected contexts, including ones where they have the power to persuade. They're giving interviews advocating for tougher gun laws, such as when the family of Joaquin Oliver, a victim of the 2018 Parkland school shooting in Florida, created an avatar of him. They had it speak with journalist Jim Acosta in July.
I would like to know what your solution would be for gun violence.
Great question. I believe in a mix of stronger gun control laws, mental health support, and community engagement.
And in May, the family of Chris Pelkey, the deceased victim of a road rage incident, created an avatar of him. It delivered a video statement at the sentencing of the man who fatally shot Pelkey.
To Gabriel Horcasitas, the man who shot me. It is a shame we encountered each other that day in those circumstances.
After hearing the statement, the judge handed down the maximum sentence.
There is powerful rhetoric with a dead bot because it is tapping into all of that emotional longing and vulnerability.
New Yorker cartoonist Amy Kurzweil's work frequently explores technological topics, including her 2023 book, Artificial: A Love Story. The graphic memoir recounts how she and her father, inventor and futurist Ray Kurzweil, created a text-based chatbot of her dead grandfather in 2018.
I could feel like I had some communion with his presence.
Kurzweil says more immersive voice and video-based dead bots may have even stronger powers of persuasion. Researchers are concerned they might soon start selling you things. Lindenwood University AI researcher James Hudson is the co-author of several studies about dead bots.
Of course, it will be monetized.
Hudson's work, along with other recent studies, such as one from Cambridge University, which highlights the potential for companies to use dead bots to advertise products to users, point to the potential harms of such uses.
If it is perceived as exploitative, right?
But Hudson says the American public has nevertheless been primed to accept the possibility of ads being fed to them through dead bots, whether famous or familial.
Something that might seem very crass and horrifying today is not going to seem so far-fetched or inappropriate once it becomes normalized and fairly common.
Hudson says, for one thing, the deceased have been promoting products on screen for decades. A digitally manipulated Fred Astaire was careening about in vacuum cleaner commercials way back in the 1990s.
The amazing ultra swivel glide. Nothing escapes the power of a dirt devil.
For another, Hudson says it hasn't taken long for consumers to begrudgingly accept commercials as part of their paid subscriptions to streamers like Hulu and Netflix. So why not ad-supported dead bots too? Before this can happen, there are legal kinks to work out. Jeffrey Rosenthal is an attorney in Philadelphia specializing in technology and privacy with the law firm Blank Rome LLP.
In America, we're struggling with the privacy rights of the living, let alone the privacy rights of the deceased.
Rosenthal says there are various state laws in the U.S. that recognize a person's right to protect the commercial use of their name, likeness, voice, and other identifying characteristics, even after they're dead. But the current legal framework is overall ill-equipped to handle the harms that might arise from, say, a grandmother deadbot spouting ads at family members.
Who is liable? The software company that developed the digital grandmother? The advertising company that inserted their ad? The company that owns the IP?
Even if the law says it's okay to put ads in Granny Bot's mouth, some dead bot makers aren't quite ready to go there right now.
Why the hell would I want my grandma to say anything that's not authentic?
Alex Quinn is the CEO of Authentic Interactions Incorporated, the parent company of dead bot maker Storyfile.
It would really turn me off as a consumer, and I don't think that leaves us with a high level of reputation.
But Quinn says he's absolutely interested in seeing if there are other ways to make dead bots ad-friendly.
We can instruct those avatars to actually probe for information. Who's your favorite athlete? You know, what jerseys might be interesting to you?
He says he can also imagine a world where interstitial ads get sprinkled into people's conversations with dead bots, just like how traditional commercial breaks pop up during TV shows. But he'd rather keep GrannyBot out of it. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com.
A big change is coming to online shopping on Friday. That's when a new policy takes effect. It's known as the de minimis rule on international shipments to the U.S. NPR's Bill Chappell reports it's already making waves.
De minimis is Latin, meaning something is trifling or of little importance. For more than 90 years, it let people skip import fees for shipping things of small value. But in 2016, the U.S. sharply raised its de minimis threshold to $800, one of the highest in the world. De minimis shipments now dominate cargo entering the U.S. Think Temu or Etsy vendors. Basically, Americans are...
everyone's favorite shopper. That's a great way to put it, yes.
That's Courtney Griffin of the Consumer Federation of America.
We buy a lot of stuff, and so it does mean it affects everyone as a result.
Griffin says the flood of duty-free packages comes with some risks.
It's created significant product safety concerns because low-value imports are facing minimal customs inspection, making it easier for unsafe or non-compliant product to enter the U.S. market.
Customs and Border Protection says it processes around 4 million de minimis shipments every day. With numbers like that, policymakers are calling the exemption a loophole. People who want to keep the de minimis rule say it gives U.S. consumers low prices, but critics say it favors foreign companies. Here's President Trump speaking about it earlier this year.
It's a big scam going on against our country, against really small businesses, and we've ended. We put an end to it.
Trump says suspending the rule will help the U.S. trade deficit and make it harder to import illegal drugs like fentanyl. An earlier suspension of de minimis focused on China, but this time the new rule is global. With the new policy set to take effect on Friday, international postal and shipping services are suspending delivery of some packages to the U.S. They're trying to figure out two things: how to handle new paperwork for millions of packages, and how to collect money for duties and taxes. The U.S. rule has exceptions. Letters aren't affected, and people can send gifts worth less than $100 to each other. I asked Griffin if she has any advice for consumers.
The first would be, when possible, buy domestically. This would be a route to avoid import fees, potential shipping delays.
She says people should look for changes to retailer shipping and return policies, especially in the upcoming holiday season. Griffin also says to look out for scammers trying to profit off of confusion over the new policy. Bill Chappell, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
18 minutes after 4 o'clock. Thanks for listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, our daily dose of phonology with John Latimer. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. Mostly clear tonight with lows in the low 50s and mostly sunny tomorrow, high 75 to 80, slight chance of showers in the afternoon.
On today's date, August 26th in the year 2001, I note that the ragweed has begun to bloom. Oftentimes, ragweed is ignored for just about all of the year. And then, all at once, in the fall, people who are sufferers of hay fever find that there is an unbelievable amount of irritation for their nose, and most of it comes from ragweed. Oftentimes people are quick to point to the goldenrod and say, it's the goldenrod pollen. But if you look at the pollen of both the ragweed and the goldenrod under a microscope, The goldenrod pollen is innocuous and tiny compared to the ragweed pollen. The ragweed pollen looks like one of those spiky balls that you saw in medieval warfare, those giant balls with spikes all over them. And that's essentially what ragweed pollen looks like under a microscope. And you can imagine what that might feel like if you inhaled a bunch of it and if your nose were extra sensitive to that kind of an irritation. So don't blame the goldenrod. It's the ragweed that's blooming right now. And if you are sensitive to pollen and to hay fever, no doubt you know that already.
Comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Nearly 2 years into the war in Gaza, UNICEF estimates that more than 50,000 Palestinian children have been killed or injured. Reporter Ari Daniel brings us this story from nearby Lebanon, where a doctor and his team are racing to heal the handful of kids they can reach.
It's clear in an instant. Dr. Hassan Abu Sitta is just really good with kids.
Adin Fain?
Here at his weekly clinic at the American University of Beirut Medical Center, he's meeting 6-year-old Kenzie Madhun for the first time. Kenzie has eyes the color of dark chocolate. Her face is framed beneath a pink straw hat that covers a scar above her hairline. On her left hand, I see the drawing of a little heart. Her right arm, though, is missing. Kenzie's dad, Adam Madhun, brought her here to Lebanon, hoping Abu Sitta and his colleagues can help his daughter have a normal life.
What I wish for is for her to do whatever she wants to do. Like there are games that need two hands, or when she wants to wear her clothes, the simplest things.
But these simple things will require many complexities. To start with, Dr. Abu Sitta says he's focusing on Kenzie's missing limb.
The biggest question is, how can I improve the quality of that remnant of her upper arm? Because that is the determinant of the quality of the prosthetic that she'll get.
The doctor escorts the father and daughter into an exam room. Kenzie walks confidently with the group of adults. Abu Sitta says that during his assessment, he'll not just be looking at Kenzie as the 6-year-old she is today, but also as the 18-year-old she'll become.
You are trying to reconstruct a moving object, which is the growing body that always outgrows the injured part.
And that means multiple surgeries over multiple years. It's work that Abu Sitta has mastered over 3 decades, repairing the wounds of thousands of children like Kenzie, caught in the crossfire of war. He chose this path as a teenager, he says, growing up in Kuwait in a Palestinian family. During the summer of 1982, he remembers watching Israel's invasion of Lebanon on the news.
Seeing medical teams treating the wounded was a strong influence on not just wanting to become a doctor, but the kind of doctor that I wanted to become.
That is, a reconstructive and plastic surgeon who treats those wounded in war.
War injuries are probably the most complex of reconstructive challenges. An explosive will blow rubble, shrapnel into the body. The wave of the blast devitalizes tissues and kills them, and so that needs to all be removed before you can consider reconstructing the limb.
Over the years, Abu Sitta has treated the wounded in numerous conflicts, but it's in Gaza where Abu Sitta has felt a particular calling to help when violence has flared there over and over again. October 7th was no exception after Hamas-led militants led a surprise attack on communities in southern Israel, killing 1,200 and kidnapping 251 more, according to Israeli authorities. Powerful Israeli retaliatory attacks on Gaza followed.
On the 9th of October, I went into Gaza.
It was shortly thereafter when I first reached Abu Sitta by phone at one of the hospitals in the north. He told me he was hearing shelling every few minutes.
A lot of the wounded are women and children. Sometimes the child is the only survivor. We're about to do another patient with much bigger wound in his thigh, a kind of blast injury. So I'm going to need to go take care. Bye-bye.
Abu Sitta says the conditions in Gaza this time were unlike anything he'd ever seen.
It's the difference between a flood and a tsunami. The scale, the intensity, the sheer ferociousness.
There was only so much Abu Sitta could do from the inside. So after 43 days, he left Gaza and eventually made his way to Lebanon.
The expertise in the management of war wounds in Lebanon doesn't exist anywhere else. And so I felt that this is really the place to bring wounded kids for complex reconstructive surgery.
Meanwhile, in Lebanon, many were watching the suffering in Gaza, wanting to help, like Doreen Dandashly, a social activist and former banker.
The fact that you cannot do anything to change what you feel, it's heavy. It's eating us, you know, the helpless feeling, and it's like cancer.
She and a few others knew of Dr. Hassan Abu Sitta, so in partnership with him, they formed a fund in his name, with the idea of helping war-injured children who've made it out of Gaza. Children like Kenzie Madhun, the 6-year-old with the pink hat. Do you like to dress fashionably?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. 2 weeks after October 7th, Kenzie tells me she was sitting in the garden with her grandfather in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza.
We heard things and then we thought it was fireworks, but it wasn't.
It was an airstrike. The force of the explosion propelled her into the air.
The missile took me up.
Kenzie felt like she was flying, like a superhero. When she landed, she lost consciousness. Her father, Adam Madhun, wasn't with her, but a journalist friend called to tell him of the attack, that Kenzie had been pulled from the rubble.
They told me that Kenzie died.
Madhun rushed to his daughter and arrived an hour later to discover Kenzie was still alive. Like a phoenix, he says. But she was severely wounded, a fractured pelvis and skull, and a missing arm. Since then,
we stayed together. We've been like twins. I didn't not see her for any day.
Kenzie and her dad managed to leave Gaza, and over the next year and a half, they alternated between Egypt and Turkey for treatment. But it became clear that she needed to see doctors practiced in healing the particular wounds of war. And so Kenzie and her dad arrived in Lebanon to meet with Abu Sitta and his team. Their first meeting was here at his weekly clinic.
And Shuf is a distraction, is a possibility.
Here?
Abu Sitta asks his colleagues to order an x-ray of Kenzie's right shoulder because he wants to see if distraction is possible, a procedure that would elongate what's left of her upper arm bone by first fracturing it into two parts.
And then you move them away from each other by 1 millimeter every day, and that induces newborn formation.
Ultimately, Abu Sitta's colleague, a world expert in bone distraction here, determines he can give Kenzie a critical 3 extra inches in her stump.
It means that what she will end up with is a prosthesis that doesn't have to be secured to her body through a shoulder strap that goes to the other side, but is able to stick to her limb, which makes it better, more appealing physically and functionally.
The process will be painful, the first step in a long medical journey ahead. Kenzie's father is ready. Kenzie is scared.
I'm really afraid. I don't like needles.
I understand. You feel a little nervous now. Is that kind of how you're feeling?
Of course.
That was last Friday. Today was Kenzie's surgery. Abu Sitta sent me this message.
It went very well. We just finished now. It went very well.
The phoenix has started to regrow her wing. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel, Beirut.
This is NPR News.
President.
It is 4:29. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, national Native news. And 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. We receive support from the McKnight Foundation and from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic GigaZone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. Our lows tonight in the low 50s with mostly clear skies and mostly sunny tomorrow. High 75 to 80, slight chance for rain in the afternoon. And looking ahead to Thursday, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 60s to low 70s. Native American Music and Arts Festival is this Sunday, August 31st, from 10 to 5 at the Mille Lacs Indian Museum and Trading Post near Onamia. There will be artists, demonstrations, live music, and food trucks. Let us know what's happening in your community. Email us, psa@kaxe.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In what the South Dakota Attorney General calls the end of a three-decade legal saga, courts have upheld the extradition of John Graham. Graham was convicted of the 1975 murder of Annie Mae Aquash. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's CJ Keene has more.
Annie Mae Aquash was an American Indian Movement activist whose long unsolved kidnapping, rape, and murder shocked South Dakota and the nation in the mid-1970s. Her body was discovered in a rural area near Juan Blee with a gunshot wound which traveled up from the hairline through the head. State Attorney General Marty Jackley describes the crime as an execution and says he's confident in the result of the trial. As a former United States Attorney for South Dakota, Jackley has long been involved in the case.
Ultimately, Graham took issue with the Canadian extradition, and today, ultimately, the Canadian Ministry of Justice has affirmed and reconsented to the extradition, and so John Graham will remain convicted of the execution of Annie Mae Aquash and shall continue to serve his life imprisonment without the chance of parole.
Graham, a Canadian national, was arrested for the murder in 2003. He's now 70 years old. Jackley says he believes this bookends the legal saga.
I feel realistically this is the end of the road. This is the Canadian Ministry of Justice. This is the appellate stage. So absent a governor's pardon, I feel that John Graham is where he needs to be.
Prior appeals from Graham's team have gone to the state Supreme Court, federal courts, and now through the Canadian extradition process. For National Native News, I'm CJ Keene in Rapid City.
John Graham will remain in South Dakota state custody. A federal trial began Monday in Anchorage for a class action lawsuit against the Alaska Office of Children's Services, or OCS. The lawsuit is on behalf of all children in OCS custody, which includes Alaska Natives and American Indians. Marsha Lowry is an attorney and director of a national nonprofit advocating for foster care reforms. She says they're helping with the lawsuit because Alaska's foster system has some of the worst outcomes in the country.
They have a very, very high maltreatment rate. They do not have the kids visited every month. That's a federal requirement. Children have to be visited because how else can you know whether a child is safe when you put a child in a foster home?
The complaint alleges OCS caseworkers have too many cases to be able to adequately serve families. It also alleges the agency has failed to place Alaska Native foster children in culturally appropriate placements, violating the Indian Child Welfare Act. OCS Director Kim Guay also took the stand. She said all OCS employees are working to make positive changes in the system and that the agency has taken steps to increase recruitment and improve training, and repeatedly said that OCS is only one piece of the child welfare system. Margaret Peyton Walsh is Assistant Attorney General for the state and defending OCS in the trial. She says running the foster care system in Alaska is challenging.
It's especially hard in Alaska because of the size and the remoteness of so many of the communities. And we are doing the best that we can to manage the challenges that we have. And there are definitely challenges. Nobody is denying that. And I think critically in this context, we have a very, very severe caseworker shortage.
The trial is expected to take 3 weeks. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Yeah.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Minutes from downtown Anchorage, the Alaska Native Heritage Center is more than a museum. It's where Alaska Native traditions, languages, and arts come alive. There's always something new at the Alaska Native Heritage Center who support this show. More at alaskanative.net.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. And from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Let's get an update on the investigation into the attack on the CDC campus in Atlanta. Federal authorities haven't publicly disclosed a motive, but in a public letter, hundreds of current and former employees of the Department of Health and Human Services called it, quote, misinformation-fueled violence. NPR domestic extremism correspondent Odette Youssef says this offers a view into how the Trump administration is taking a different approach to domestic terrorism. Hi, Odette.
Hey, Ari.
First, what's the latest on the investigation into the attack on the CDC?
Well, I reached out to the FBI a week after the incident to ask if the agency is investigating the attack as a possible act of violent extremism or domestic terrorism. And the FBI referred me to the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. It said that the GBI is leading this investigation. This surprised me, Ari, first because the attack was against a federal agency. But it also suggests that the FBI has not designated this as an act of domestic terrorism. I spoke with Mike German. He's a former FBI special agent now at the Brennan Center for Justice. And he says that when the agency does designate something as domestic terrorism, that triggers a whole new level of resources for the investigation.
In other words, not just looking at the single violent incident, but any related criminal activity that might have assisted in that attack or suggest that a future attack by a co-conspirator might occur.
In this case, the gunman died, Ari, so perhaps that accounts for the FBI's decisions here, and the GBI investigation may yield more information, but I think it's an interesting data point when we look at how the FBI thinks about domestic terrorism in this moment.
What other data points are you looking at?
Well, I looked through public releases from the Department of Justice over the last 7 months, and I was looking for announcements of arrests or charges where authorities specifically used the terms domestic terrorism or domestic violent extremism. And I found those exact terms in just a few cases. A couple of them involved people who allegedly damaged Tesla vehicles. Another instance involved a man accused of helping someone detonate a car bomb outside a fertility clinic in Palm Springs. But this isn't a complete picture. And what's notable here, Ari, is that we're nearing the 24th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, and the FBI still says it cannot provide data on how many domestic terrorism investigations and prosecutions it conducts. These are data that lawmakers have been demanding for years, in fact, have required by law for years. But the FBI says it doesn't collect those numbers. Mike German says, at the very least, the agency should be able to report on the work that it does. And he says that, you know, frankly, without this data, it's impossible to identify the greatest threats to the homeland and where resources should go.
You mentioned 9/11. So much has changed since then. Do counterterrorism experts think the U.S. is prepared to face the threats the country faces today?
I spoke with Nicholas Rasmussen about this. He was the counterterrorism coordinator at the Department of Homeland Security up until Trump took office. He told me one thing giving him concern is the exodus from government service of highly experienced people who've worked on terrorism and counterterrorism issues.
I just worry that we are less capable at present than we might have been in earlier periods of time, just because of the hollowing out that comes when so many senior people or experienced people leave.
And among others that I spoke to, Ari, there's a real worry that cuts to federal grant programs and in some cases a redirection of dollars toward immigration enforcement means that local initiatives to prevent extremist and targeted violence will disappear.
Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, that could look like cutting off funds to nonprofits that run anti-Semitism programs in local communities or ending support for Christian pastors who work on countering hate and ideologically driven violence. It could look like suspending behavioral management initiatives that take a public health approach to identifying and intervening when someone may be at the very early stages of planning violence. These are programs that had been slowly building over several years with the help of federal coordination and dollars, and now that period of growth seems to be ending.
It's NPR's Odette Youssef. Thank you.
Thank you.
As Labor Day approaches, are you planning that final trip to the beach? Well, if you are, you might see Ed Kazukowicz. He's a lifeguard at Bayhead Beach in New Jersey. He's almost 83 years old now, but he got his first job as a lifeguard when he was just 18. And Guinness World Records recently named him the oldest male open water lifeguard. Ed Kazukowicz joins us now. Welcome to the program.
How you doing?
I am doing well, Ed. I have to say, spending more than 60 years as a lifeguard is incredible. What initially got you excited about becoming one?
I liked the ocean. I liked working on a beach. And when I was eligible at 18, I came down, took a test, and got the job. And that was the start of it all.
Now, you are officially now the oldest male open water lifeguard. But if I understand correctly, you didn't initially want to apply for the Guinness World Record. Is that right?
That is correct. A buddy of mine who used to be a guard at Jones Beach, he got talking to my wife at a Christmas party. And he talked to my daughter, and that's where it all started. And I told him, Bruce, I'm just doing a job. I like to be under the table, and you know, nice and quiet, nice and even, just doing a job. And he goes, no, you need this recognition. Well, my wife and daughter took it over, and that's what happened.
Well, they must be so proud of you. How do you feel now that you have that recognition, even if it wasn't something you were necessarily searching for?
I'm proud to have it. I like what I do. I like sitting with the younger kids because as a school teacher for 37 years, I was always in contact with the younger generation, so to speak. Now, I'm no longer teaching, but I do teach on a beach, and that's where I get my understanding of what the younger kids are thinking about.
Now, I do have to ask you, now that you're in your 80s, let us in on the secret. How do you stay in the type of shape necessary to be good at a job like this one, which I assume at times can be physically demanding?
I've always been physically active, and my philosophy is if I'm on a beach, I work out 2 days on the beach and the health club. During the winter season, I'm a ski instructor supervisor in a ski ride school at Ski Wyndham in New York. And I keep busy 5 days a week teaching skiing. So it's just a continuous thing that I hopefully am able to operate at the standards that need to be as lifeguarding and as a ski instructor.
Ed, what's your best advice for someone who might be hearing our conversation and maybe they want to become a lifeguard like you?
Well, if you can swim 500 meters in under 10 minutes, you can take the standard test for the most beaches. Some beaches might have additional tests that you might have to take. But if you can do that, then you can apply. And if you think you have the physical capabilities of handling somebody in the water besides yourself, try out someplace.
Ed, I have to tell you a secret. I don't think I'm going to be able to become a lifeguard anytime soon. That sounds pretty hard to me.
Now, don't give up so easily.
We've been speaking with Ed Kazukowicz. He holds the Guinness World Record for oldest male open ocean lifeguard at the age of 82. Ed, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:44 coming up in just a moment on KAXE North Star Stories, produced by Ampers, news from communities throughout the state of Minnesota. Support for KAXE comes from Patterson's Clothing in downtown Bemidji, an apparel retailer serving the Northwoods since 1930. Patterson's features clothing from brands such as Cool, Patagonia, Darn Tough, and Smartwool. PattersonsClothing.com. Registration is now open for the Itasca Orchestra Youth Strings Program. Classes begin September 15th. Learn more and register at itascaorchestra.org. And the final Summer Muse Festival of the season is Saturday, August 30th from 4 to 8 at Rail River Folk School in Bemidji, with artists, musicians, food vendors, and more. And Grand Rapids Riverfest is coming up Saturday, September 6th. We are excited to welcome Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Find your tickets and information at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
Today, a Northwestern sheriff is in trouble over an illegal elk tag. Then, federal actions create questions about Minneapolis's policies. And new help for Minnesota farmers. I'm Gracie J. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources has filed a lawsuit against the Kitson County Sheriff. The DNR alleges that the sheriff in the northwest corner of the state illegally issued a possession tag to a farmer who shot an elk eating crops last winter. According to the lawsuit, the sheriff created the document after the farmer killed the elk and assured him he wouldn't face charges. The DNR is the only agency authorized to grant such permits. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has investigated and forwarded its findings to the Kitson County Attorney's Office, which will determine if the sheriff will face criminal charges. In today's main story, when federal agents showed up in South Minneapolis this June, city police soon followed. That decision has sparked questions about whether Minneapolis is living up to its policy of keeping police out of immigration enforcement. Here's North Star Stories' Zan Holston.
Why are you here? Why are you covering your faces?
When federal agents descended on the corner of South Minneapolis's Lake and Bloomington Avenues on June 3rd, bystanders thought they were witnessing an immigration raid. Minneapolis City Councilmember Oreen Chowdhury describes it.
Armored vehicles, heavily militarized federal agents, ICE, HSI. We saw individuals with large weapons.
Homeland Security Investigations, a branch of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, later said it wasn't an immigration raid, but part of a metro-wide drug and human trafficking operation that seized more than 900 pounds of methamphetamine. Federal agents called in the Minneapolis Police Department for crowd control. But under the city's separation ordinance, city employees, including police, are barred from participating in immigration enforcement.
We're responsible for just trying to keep the...
At the scene, MPD Chief Brian O'Hara tried to explain the police presence.
Yeah, we responded after the fact because there was a crowd was forming, and the federal agents asked for help.
Days after the raid, the city council ordered an after-action review to determine whether MPD had broken the ordinance. City Auditor Robert Timmerman recently presented the results of that audit, which found no violation, but called it outdated and questioned whether it still worked as intended.
Federal immigration enforcement tactics have changed dramatically since the adoption of this ordinance in 2003.
A local activist group pushed the city council to adopt the separation ordinance in 2003 in response to immigration crackdowns following the September 11th attacks. It was meant to ensure immigrants could call 911 without fear of deportation.
2003 was a pretty bad year, and it was a really, really scary time for immigrant communities.
Sally Lieberman was part of a different group at that time, pushing the council for a resolution opposing the USA Patriot Act, legislation that expanded surveillance and gave federal agencies broader powers to detain non-citizens without warrants. She said the ordinance served its purpose then, but now it needs more teeth.
One of the hardest things to do is to address this question of police being on the scene where there's some kind of an ICE action going on.
Now, immigrant rights activists are calling for an updated, stricter separation ordinance that bans MPD from doing crowd control and sharing information with federal agents during actions, as well as real consequences if the ordinance is violated.
there isn't really any ordinance that can entirely protect us from, you know, from federal goons that don't respect people's rights.
City council members say they've already started working on an updated ordinance to better fit current enforcement tactics and close gaps that allow for cooperation between local police and federal immigration authorities. Meanwhile, the Trump administration threatened to withhold federal funding from states and cities it says are obstructing immigration enforcement. For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture is welcoming two new mental health providers to help the state's farmers. The two new counselors will be joining a third who has been serving the state since 2019. All three provide free, confidential counseling to manage stress and help develop healthy coping strategies. The three also offer educational programs and workshops. The Minnesota Legislature funds the program, which is available to farmers, family members, employees, and agricultural workers. More information is available online at minnesotafarmstress.com.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Ilsa Chang. This week marks the anniversary of one of the worst urban disasters in U.S. history, when New Orleans was devastated by Hurricane Katrina. 20 years later, parts of the city still have not fully recovered, and today it has about three-quarters of the population it had before the storm. Some neighborhoods have come back and are thriving, but in others, like New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward, NPR's Greg Allen reports that recovery still seems years, maybe decades, away.
A drive through New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward takes you past train tracks, boarded homes, empty overgrown lots, and block after block where there are few people or houses. In 2005, 15,000 people, mostly African Americans, lived in this neighborhood. Today, the population is a third of that. For many of the people who returned to rebuild their homes and lives after the storm, it's been difficult. Neighbors are gone. There are still few stores or schools. And for some, Burnell Cotlin says, life remains a daily struggle.
This is not a third world country. This is New Orleans. No, we're only 10 minutes from the French Quarters, and the people that's here in the Lower Ninth Ward, they're still suffering.
Cotlin's little grocery store on Fats Domino Avenue is one of a handful of stores that has opened in the Lower Ninth Ward in the 20 years since the storm. It's just several blocks from the place where flood walls toppled over on the Industrial Canal, unleashing a flood that washed away homes, including, Cotlin says, the one he'd bought after retiring from the Army.
I lost everything. I had to start life all over. I had like 30 plus some neighbors. Today I have four. There's nothing back here.
Cotlin says he'd never heard the term food desert until after Katrina, when he found there was nowhere in his neighborhood to buy something to eat. He purchased a concrete block building that survived the flood, rehabbed it, and opened his market. Inside the store, he shows us where he first began serving customers.
This was the grocery store window. When I tell you, everything went out this window. I sold milk, eggs, bread, cheese, you name it. It went out of this window. I did this for about almost 3 years.
There are a few other businesses in the Lower Ninth Ward now, some gas stations, a dollar store. And after running the store for more than a decade, Cotlin's is no longer open every day. After 20 years, he says, it's clear that few additional former residents are coming back. Any growth and rebuilding in the Lower Ninth Ward will have to be from newcomers. And he hasn't seen a lot of new folks coming in.
People forgot about the Lower Ninth Ward. I got to stay strong and positive, but sometimes it hurts. It hurts because when I drive from my house to come here, I remember, oh, they had a store here. They had a school here. We had a hospital here. We had everything back here.
New Orleans City Council member Oliver Thomas says people who visit the Lower Ninth today may not know what it was like when he was growing up there in the early 1960s.
At one point, we were a booming population of over 20,000 people. One of the largest African-American communities, where 61% of us owned our own homes. And it was a working-class community. We may not have lived in mansions or palaces, but the people in the Lower Ninth Ward owned their property. It was ours.
Cynthia Gilmet also grew up here and recalls an earlier flood from Hurricane Betsy in 1965. In that storm, levees on the Mississippi River and the Industrial Canal breached, flooding the neighborhood. The difference, she says, is that after that storm, the neighborhood bounced back.
After Betsy in 65, everyone returned because the water went away quickly. Everyone returned and everyone started rebuilding. The residents at that time, the parents, were younger. So that made a difference between then and coming back with Katrina.
Councilman Thomas says the distribution of money after Katrina discriminated against residents in the Lower Ninth Ward and other neighborhoods by basing grants on their home's value before the storm, not on the cost of rebuilding. Now, two decades on, he says many who couldn't return have left their properties to their children.
A lot of it was tied up in red tape with families and heirs, liens, taxes on properties. That's one of the things that probably would have helped if the state and the city would have helped cut the red tape to who had rights to property. And then a lot of the speculators bought up hordes of blighted property or vacant property, and many of them are still holding on to it now.
Here and there in the Lower Ninth, there are some good things happening. The old Holy Cross High School, shuttered since Katrina, has been redeveloped as an apartment building with a promise that it will attract new residents to the community. And as you drive from the French Quarter over the St. Claude Bridge into the Lower Ninth, one of the first businesses you see is a new produce market. It was opened by Sankofa, a local nonprofit. Rashida Ferdinand is its director.
Sankofa is a word from Ghana in West Africa, and it's a concept that means go back to the past to build for the future.
In the market, there are tomatoes, greens, eggplants, okra, sweet potatoes, much of it locally grown. It's the only place in the neighborhood where you can find fresh produce. Ferdinand grew up in the Lower Ninth and after college came back.
I think as soon as I came home, I wanted to be involved in that energy to really support rebuilding this area. And folks were getting together and trying to do some good things, and I wanted to be a part of it.
She founded Sankofa more than a decade ago to help rebuild the place where she grew up. The market, she says, is one of several projects in the works.
All of our spaces are intended to be hubs of fun, of recreation, of education, of vitality. And so this market is one of those spaces centered around healthy food.
Several blocks away, Sankofa has transformed empty lots into a vegetable farm.
These are marigolds that we're growing along with our okra.
Marlon Ford, an urban agriculture specialist from Southern University, works with volunteers and members of the community. Among other things, he shows them how to raise and harvest okra.
Look at the beautiful flower. And see, the key to it, you don't want it to get too large. 3 inches, and then you cut with a slant. If you cut it wrong, you open it up for disease.
Sankofa is working on a plan to transform some 40 acres of vacant lots in the Lower Ninth into vegetable gardens. The group has also helped build a park and nature trail in a wetlands area that had been a site for illegal dumping. The idea, Ferdinand says, is create events and spaces that help build community. City officials support Sankofa's work. But after languishing for two decades, she says what the Lower Ninth really needs is a systematic governmental plan to rebuild the neighborhood.
The investment is not here. There's consistent blight, pervasive blight. There's not even planning data that's been created and assessed. So having an intentional plan to build, redevelop a space is the first step.
As of now, the main government agency with a plan for the Lower Ninth is the Port of New Orleans. It's approved a new grain terminal with rail lines running through the neighborhood. Homeowners worry it will undercut their efforts to attract new people to a neighborhood that too often has been neglected. With producer Marisa Pinulosa, I'm Greg Allen, NPR News, New Orleans.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station. This is NPR.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at Viking.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. From Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It is a minute before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our news team. At 7 o'clock, Will Owens, your volunteer host for On the River, great mix of music.